Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. President Obama calls for unity to advance ideas.
Unless we work with other nations under the mantle of international norms and principles and law that offer legitimacy to our efforts, we will not succeed.
U.S. President Barack Obama called on the world Monday to shun war and conflict and instead engage in new diplomatic efforts to resolve conflicts across the globe. The American leader told the United Nations General Assembly that we will all be stronger if we work together, and it's time to move away from force and coercion.
And unless we work together to defeat the ideas that drive different communities in a country like Iraq into conflict, any order that our militaries can impose will be temporary. And just as force alone cannot impose order internationally, I believe in my core that repression cannot forge the social cohesion for nations to succeed.
Yet Mr. Obama also defended U.S. military strength and the U.S. campaign against Islamic State insurgents in the Middle East. He criticized Russia for its annexation a year ago of Ukraine's Crimea Peninsula and involvement in support of pro-Russian separatists in the eastern Ukraine. A developing story in Africa, Burkina Faso's army says the elite presidential guard, known as the RSP, that was behind a recent coup attempt, is refusing to be disarmed.
The soldiers want some guarantee regarding their safety, because there has been the transitional government said they will open an inquiry regarding the coup, and the soldiers feel they could be in danger of being prosecuted. So they have requested an amnesty before. But so far, it hasn't been agreed on. So they are trying to pressure the government to give them some guarantee before giving by the weapon.
VOA's Emily Yube in the capital of Ouagadougou. Cabinet expected to hold an emergency meeting on Monday. This is VOA News. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani will leave New York for Tehran on Monday, cutting short his visit for the UN General Assembly so he can take part in a ceremony for the Iranians killed in a stampede during the annual Hajj pilgrimage. Some 169 Iranians have been confirmed dead among the 769 killed last week outside the holy city of Mecca in Saudi Arabia. More than 300 Iranians remain missing. On Sunday, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei demanded Saudi Arabia apologize for the stampede. Saudi Foreign Minister Abdel bin Ahmed Al Jubeir accused Iran of politically exploiting the tragedy.
If mistakes were made, we will; those who made them will be held accountable, and we will make sure that we will learn from this in order to ensure that it doesn't happen again. But I want to repeat again, this is not a situation with which to play politics. I would hope that the Iranian leaders would be more sensible and more thoughtful with regards to those who perished in this tragedy, and wait until we see the results of the investigation.
Iranians protested Sunday outside the Saudi embassy in Tehran for a third straight day. For more on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. Insurgent officials and Afghan media confirmed Monday evening the Taliban has seized control of Kunduz after staging a pre-dawn well-coordinated offensive against the northern city. Ayaz Ghul has more from Islamabad.
Local officials and insurgents say the Taliban staged a pre-dawn coordinated attack on Kunduz, and by mid-afternoon, it seized control of key parts of the city near the border with Tajikistan. Afghan media quoted eyewitnesses as confirming the Taliban advances, reporting dozens of casualties among Afghan local police forces. But authorities insisted national security forces have repelled the insurgent attack and are currently engaged in operations to clear Kunduz. The Taliban assaulted Kunduz at a time when the provincial governor is visiting neighboring Tajikistan and senior security officials are also reportedly visiting Kabul. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Interior Ministry spokesman Sadiq Siddiqui told VOA earlier in the day that National Security Forces killed up to 25 insurgents, claiming there are no casualties among Afghan forces. Royal Dutch Shell said Monday it is, for the foreseeable future, halting its oil drilling operations in the Arctic waters off the coast of the U.S. state of Alaska. A company statement said an exploratory well found indications of oil and gas. Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The march of human progress never travels in a straight line. That our work is far from complete. That dangerous currents risk pulling us back into a darker, more disordered world.
That's President Obama addressing the United Nations General Assembly today. Details coming up.
Also, Britain is sending 370 military personnel to support peacekeeping efforts in Somalia and South Sudan. And after a year of relative calm, the Central African Republic's capital broke out in sectarian clashes over the weekend.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ivory Coast, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Burkina Faso's army says the elite presidential guard behind a recent coup attempt is refusing to be disarmed. The army says the planned disarmament of the guard, known as the RSP, has reached a dead end. It says the guard will not give up their weapons. It also cites what it calls the ambiguous behavior of RSP chief and coup leader General Gilbert Diendere. The disarmament effort began on Friday, the day Burkina Faso's leaders officially disbanded the guard. The cabinet is expected to hold an emergency meeting to discuss the situation. Civil society groups have called for people to protest. Presidential Guard members launched the coup attempt by arresting interim president Michel Kafando and other ministers on September 16th.
Prime Minister David Cameron is expected to announce today that Britain is sending 370 military personnel to support peacekeeping efforts in Somalia and South Sudan. Cameron has described the troops as engineers and medical personnel. Some will offer logistical support for the African Union peacekeeping force of 22,000 in Somalia. Most of the British troops are engineers being sent to support UN efforts in South Sudan, where government and rebel forces have recently signed a peace agreement.
After a year of relative calm, the Central African Republic's capital broke out in sectarian clashes over the weekend. Hospital workers in Bangui have reported 36 dead and more than 80 wounded by Sunday evening. The government has announced a 6 p.m. curfew throughout the city. Reuters news agency reports Muslims allegedly killed an estimated 21 people in a Christian neighborhood on Saturday after the body of a Muslim was discovered near a mosque. More deaths occurred early yesterday when Christian anti-Balaka militias armed with assault rifles and machetes roamed the streets. Protesters threw up barricades of tree trunks and youths demonstrated for peace. Soldiers from the UN peacekeeping mission MINUSCA fired tear gas at crowds in an unsuccessful attempt to clear the roads. Thousands of Central Africans have died and hundreds of thousands remain displaced after 2 years of violence when Muslim Seleka rebels seized power in the majority Christian country in 2013. The nation goes to the polls October 18th to elect a parliament and a new president to replace interim president Catherine Samba Panza. Well, the Tribal People's Rights Organization Survival International says a recent investigation in Ethiopia's Lower Omo Valley reveals evidence of human rights abuses against the ancestral tribes. Survival International calls the situation in the Lower Omo Valley very serious. Campaigner Elizabeth Hunter says the Ethiopian government is evicting tribal people from their ancestral land and relocating them to resettlement villages.
This means that most of their land they're being forced to give up, and this land is crucial to their livelihood. It's where they graze their cattle, where, for example, the Kwegu hunter-gatherer tribe gets honey from beehives they keep in the bush there and hunt. So this is a very serious situation, and also this is not being done with the tribal people's consent.
Hunter says while they did not have direct access to the indigenous people, they learned of the alleged abuses through reports from donor government missions in the region. The information was released based on the Freedom of Information Act in the UK.
This is very important because they did have access to the tribal peoples in the area, visited a number of the resettlement areas. So this is first-hand information that they didn't want released. And in fact, the UK government refused to give Survival the report, and we eventually obtained it through the European Union, which is one of the biggest donor agencies, along with the UK and the US, to Ethiopia.
One of the main findings of the report was that the tribal people did not give prior consent to be moved off of their land. Hunter says that goes against the donor country guidelines.
It also found conditions, particularly in one resettlement camp, were deplorable. People were suffering from malaria, from bloody diarrhea, and the government wasn't letting them leave the area. It also said that the impact of the plantations, because once the government is clearing the people off their ancestral land and putting them into the resettlement areas, this has freed up the land for a huge government plantation for sugarcane called the Kura, and this is massive.
Alimayehu Tegeno is the Minister of Water, Irrigation and Energy for Ethiopia. He disputes the findings, saying the government has not forcibly removed tribal people from their land.
We didn't do such kind of activity. We didn't force people from their land. They are at their own land. And even when we constructed social infrastructures, schools, health stations, for the community in the area. I think that is not true report. That is false, totally false.
Hunter says the Omo River is a crucial lifeline for people living along it. They are able to irrigate their crops through the river's natural flooding. However, she says the nearly completed Gibe 3 dam will have a huge negative impact on the area.
It means that the natural flood won't occur anymore, so people will not be able to cultivate their crops, for example, along the riverside. And this will have a huge effect on downstream in northern Kenya, where the Turkana people and others live around northern Turkana. And some of the predicted figures for the drop of Lake Turkana are huge. So all the people there who depend on fishing in Lake Turkana will see their livelihoods destroyed.
Minister Alimayehu says the Ethiopian government has been communicating and working with people for some time now who live along the river to help put infrastructure into place.
The people along the river of Omo are not forced, as you mentioned. They are there. Rather, the government started development of social and basic infrastructure to benefit the lower Omo community.
Another revelation Hunter pointed out from the recently released donor agency report was that in order for the government to maintain the sugar plantations, about 500,000 workers are needed. She said this influx of migrants would fundamentally change the way of life for the tribal people. Alimayehu says this is not what is happening in the region.
We have a very big concern for our community. This is the basic thing always we do. It is not the Ethiopian plan to displace people and disbenefit our people. Our plan is to benefit our people. Our plan is to develop different infrastructure to benefit our people. This is true for any community in Ethiopia.
The Ethiopian minister encourages anyone who would like to visit the region to do so, to see for themselves what is going on. At the same time, Survivors Hunter argues people in the lower Omo Valley are living in fear and have told donor missions that if they were to come back to the region next year, they probably would not be alive. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
The Associated Press reports 17 Syrians have drowned yesterday when their boat sank near Turkey's Bodrum Peninsula. The small vessel was headed for the Greek island of Leros. The Greek Coast Guard rescued 20 other migrants and refugees from the boat. The rescue was one of more than 30 operations the Greek Coast Guard conducted in the waters of the Aegean in the last 3 days. It rescued almost 1,000 people from boats adrift in the Aegean. More than 250,000 asylum seekers have passed through Greece so far this year. The vast majority are Syrians, Iraqis, and Afghans fleeing conflict. From the Greek mainland, they travel overland through the Balkans to European Union countries such as Germany, Austria, and Scandinavian countries.
President Obama addressed the UN General Assembly today. During his speech, he said the United States is willing to work with any country to end the war in Syria, including Russia and Iran. However, Mr. Obama said any peace in Syria cannot include Syrian President Assad remaining in office. He also said that the world cannot stand by while Russia violates Ukraine's integrity and sovereignty. He warned that if there are no consequences for Russia's annexation of Crimea, it could happen to any other country in the United Nations. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehisu Heap, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Burkina Faso's army says the elite presidential guard behind the recent coup attempt is refusing to be disarmed. Britain is preparing to send a total of up to 370 peacekeepers to aid African Union and United Nations efforts in Somalia and South Sudan. And after a year of relative calm, the Central African Republic's capital broke out in sectarian clashes over the weekend. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
A new report says development in Africa will suffer unless there's much greater investment in addressing climate change. It says much of that investment is needed for smallholder farmers. VOA's Joe DiCapua has the story.
The report's been released by the Montpelier Panel, a group of European and African experts on agriculture, trade, development, and ecology. Dr. Camilla Tuhlman is co-chair and a senior fellow at the International Institute for Environment and Development.
What we see is already growing impacts in terms of rising temperatures, but also increasing variability in the rain that does fall within the farming system. And that variability makes the cropping system more vulnerable both to flood and to drought and to reduced yields.
She says while individual farmers are doing their best to adapt, a unified approach is needed.
There's a whole number of different initiatives underway to try and address the impact of climate change on African agriculture. There's a big movement around something called Climate Smart Agriculture that's brought together a number of the big agencies, but there's not really enough in the way of a concerted effort across the continent as a whole.
The report not only recommends building resilience to climate change, but also proposes paying farmers for their efforts to mitigate its effects. Tuhlman says this includes planting trees on their farmland.
They're providing a public benefit for the world as a whole. So we're looking at various ways in which local funding can come down to farm level to support that growth in high carbon soils, high carbon landscapes.
A high carbon landscape stores large amounts of carbon in forest biomass or peat and prevents carbon emissions from entering the atmosphere. The report, The Farms of Change, lists problems that it says could have catastrophic results on African development. These include rising temperatures causing crop damage and food losses.
We need to be encouraging ministers of agriculture all the way down to farm level to build farming systems that really celebrate diversity in terms of the crops grown, in terms of cropping and trees being combined together, so that you build a system that's much less vulnerable to the impact of rainfall variability and rising temperatures.
Other potential threats are increased child malnutrition, food price hikes, worsening poverty, and unplanned migration.
Speaking of somebody who's sitting in Europe and seeing these terrible scenes of large numbers of people desperate to try and cross the Mediterranean Sea and to reach safety in Europe, you get some sense of the large numbers of people who are finding life impossible in the countries that they originally come from.
The Montpelier panel says that between 2010 and 2050, the annual cost for adaptation to climate change in sub-Saharan Africa will be at least $18 billion, but it could be as high as $50 billion for the entire continent. The panel describes current funding as paltry. Despite $34 billion being pledged to sub-Saharan Africa between 2003 and 2013, it says the region received just $2.3 billion.
Clearly, we need to be investing more, not only in agriculture, but also in the institutional foundations that strengthen farmers' ability to invest in their land. So one of the things I'm thinking is particularly key is making sure that local farmers have got firm rights, verifiable rights, documented rights to the land on which they farm and to the wider landscape that needs to be managed effectively.
Toulmin calls climate change a business opportunity, creating a need for new technologies and new jobs, not just in agriculture, but in water and energy. The report recommends greater weather research and monitoring to understand how crops and livestock respond to drought, floods, and stress from heat. It also calls for more accurate estimates as to how many people will suffer from food and nutrition insecurity. This would help in planning strategies to build resilience to climate change. The Montpelier panel report is in line with the second of the 17 new UN Sustainable Development Goals. That is to end hunger, achieve food security and improved nutrition, and promote sustainable agriculture. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
A Zimbabwean professional hunter appeared in court today to face charges. He helped an American dentist kill Cecil, a popular lion at the Zimbabwean National Park. Sebastian Monfu has more from Hiwangi, Zimbabwe.
Theodore Bronkhorst pleaded not guilty Monday to charges of assisting an illegal hunt and not preventing an illegal hunt. The charges stem from the killing of the lion in Wange National Park, about 800 kilometers southwest of Harare in July. In return for a reported $50,000, Broncos allegedly helped American dentist Walter Palmer lure Cecil out of a protected area, wound him with an arrow, and then kill him with a rifle. The killing sparked outrage from wildlife conservationists and forced the dentist to temporarily close his practice in the U.S. state of Minnesota. After his court appearance Monday in the town of Wange, Bronkhorst had this brief answer when asked by journalists if he was innocent.
Absolutely. I still believe in the sustainable use of wildlife, and I believe that at the end of the day, wildlife must be the winner.
The 52-year-old hunter faces a separate charge of trying to smuggle 29 sables worth about $435,000 to South Africa. This kind of intense crackdown for poaching and smuggling is a first for Zimbabwe. Since the Sisu incident, the professional hunting business has come under scrutiny. Hunting has been banned in some parts of the country, and authorities have increased the number of anti-poaching patrols. That followed the Chinese government contributing $2.3 million for anti-poaching efforts in the country. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Wange, Zimbabwe.
A new study by the International Labour Organization finds more than half of all people 65 years and older have no access to urgently needed long-term care. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva. The ILO study is being launched on the International Day of Older Persons.
The study of 46 countries covers 80% of the world population aged 65 and over. It finds an alarming lack of social protection for this aging population and a global shortfall of 13.6 million workers to care for its needs. The report says 300 million elderly people are incapacitated in various ways. Many have lost their mobility and cannot walk. Some may have mental illnesses such as Alzheimer's, while others may need daily assistance to tend to their basic health needs. ILO Health Policy Coordinator and author of the study, Shenya Shale Adlung, says the whole long-term care issue is largely neglected due to both age and gender discrimination.
This age discrimination and gender discrimination, but particularly age discrimination, is publicly not considered as a serious concern. Other than other forms of discrimination, we find that it is largely accepted that, for example, older people get less services, they are expected to consume less public funds. But if we compare rehabilitation services, which are needed both by younger and older persons, we find that older persons get much less.
The report says in Africa, which lacks 1.5 million long-term care workers, more than 90% of older persons do not receive care. It says the need for long-term healthcare workers in absolute numbers is greatest in Asia and the Pacific. It says this region lacks 8.2 million workers, depriving 65% of the over 65 population of assistance. Older people generally do better in Europe, but the report notes even European countries spend on average only 2% or less of their gross domestic product on long-term care for the elderly. Due to the shortage of healthcare workers, the International Labour Organization says unpaid female family members end up caring for up to 80% of all older people in need of assistance. The ILO study says global populations are rapidly aging and few countries in the world are prepared to deal with their increasing needs. The ILO is calling for universal coverage and protection for the elderly, financed by national social insurance plans or taxes. It notes increasing the long-term care workforce would provide quality care for older people and generate much-needed jobs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, we'll come to you live from New York, where world leaders are gathering for the United Nations General Assembly. They will address a variety of global concerns, including the European migrants crisis, climate change, and this year's UNGA theme, the UN at 70, A New Commitment to Action, Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on Straight Talk Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Burkina Faso's army says the elite presidential guard is behind a recent coup attempt and they're refusing to be disarmed. Britain is preparing to send a total of up to 370 peacekeepers to aid AU and UN efforts in Somalia and South Sudan. And after a year of relative calm, the Central African Republic's capital breaks out in sectarian clashes over the weekend. Coming up, we'll have music from Ivory Coast. And in our feature segment, a UN special investigator warns Burundi could slip back into open warfare. I'm Kim Lewis with Hayes Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are beginning with African athletics.
Kim, our starting line on the Sunny Side of Sports is African athletics. Kenya is celebrating another sweep of the men's and women's titles at a major international marathon. Eliud Kipchoge and Gladys Cherono were the big winners at the 42nd BMW Berlin Marathon in Germany. Kipchoge, who won the London Marathon in April, added the Berlin crown to his impressive athletic resume by clocking a personal best 2 hours and 4 minutes even. And Cherono won the women's race in 2 hours, 19 minutes, and 25 seconds. In a post-race interview with the energetic Andy Edwards, the 30-year-old Kipchoge says he's now thinking about running in the Olympics next year in Brazil.
No, after Berlin, I need to go and concentrate and prepare and plan for Rio. But before Rio, Rio is still some 11 months to go. I need to run one marathon before Rio, but exactly I don't know which one, but I need to go for one marathon and then go to Rio.
Because your record now is so impressive, 6 marathons, 5 wins and a second place. I mean, perhaps some might say, well, why run another marathon? But is it that you want to, before the Olympics, but is it that you want to keep in that groove? I mean, there's the danger of sometimes overtraining and not having enough racing.
Okay, 11 months is too long, and I need to have a race, another marathon hotel to put that and test it, to put out the reacts, and also the hotel to put on the mine. Another marathon is coming. You know, it's the main thing is the mine, not the body. If you train for 11 months, true. The mind might get tired. So it's better for the body to get tired than the mind to get tired. So I hope for both the mind and the body, then I'll have to have one marathon before Olympics.
So it's interesting because you've talked before about how important the mind is. So that would be one of the big spring marathons, I presume, next year.
Hopefully, yes.
Is there another danger? I mean, you're a man who seems to have avoided the dangers, the pitfalls of training. You've got the training right for the marathon. But, you know, I can imagine a lot of people say, if I'm going to the Olympics, I've got to train extra hard, or I've got to do more, I've got to do something different to what I have been doing. I mean, would you anticipate doing anything that much different?
Not really, but, you know, I've been with my coach for the rest of my life in athletics, and I don't think I can have something, but I will continue with a normal program, and it will help me to come with a medal or with a gold medal in Rio. My program actually has been very good. It gives me good preparation, and that's the goal for each sportsman, that. Better preparation is better than if you prepare very well, then winning can come.
And you mentioned your coach, Patrick Sang. So he's been with you from the start. I mean, people have talked about seeing you in 2003 winning that 5,000 metres on the track at the World Championships and beating Kenenisa Bekele, Hicham El-Khourouj as well. Have you and Patrick plotted a long-term approach to your athletics career?
It's really a very long time. From this is 12 years now. I have never been coached by anybody in my life in athletics. Yeah.
But when you came together, did you eventually say, or did you say to yourselves, well, one day it'll be the marathon, or was it a case of, well, let's get all we can out of your career on the track first?
We plan, actually my plan was to run very well for a ticket, which worked very well. After 2012, then we decided to move to the road and to the marathon. And the transition actually was good, and that's why I can say our plan and preparation actually are up to date.
How did you and Patrick Sang meet? Was it a chance meeting, or did somebody say, hey, you two should get together and one be the coach and one be the runner?
We come from the same village.
So it was as simple as that? You were like, yes, almost neighbors?
We are neighbors.
I mean, 12, well, more than 12 years, well, so, let's say 12, 15 years ago. I mean, was it literally a case of you were in one house and he was in another in the same village?
It's maybe about 1 kilometer, 2 kilometers apart.
Well, I think the rest of the world's runners, or runners outside of Kenya, will just stand back and think, oh, that's quite a story. Well, it sounds like you and Patrick Sang, your coach, will be planning as carefully as you've done already for 12 years or so for, well, all being well, that Olympic marathon in Rio. Eliud Kipchoge, the winner in Berlin this year. Thanks very much. Thank you, Eliud.
Thank you too. Thank you very much.
As Berlin Marathon champion Eliud Kipchoge plans and prepares for the 2016 Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, let's look ahead to the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo. Organizers in the Japanese capital are recommending 6 additional sports be included in 2020. They are baseball, softball, karate, skateboarding, sports climbing, and surfing. Under new rules, Olympic host cities can hand-pick sports they want to see contested at the Games. The final decision, though, rests with the International Olympic Committee, which will vote on the 2020 recommendations in August 2016. The Tokyo organizers want sports already popular with Japanese youth, so new venues would not need to be built. Baseball and softball were previously on the Olympic program, but were dropped after Asia last hosted the Summer Olympics in Beijing in 2008. Karate has never been contested at the Olympics. Judo, another martial art founded in Japan, first joined the Olympic program in 1964 when Tokyo last hosted the Games.
Hi, Didier Drogba, striker from Ivory Coast.
Ivorian football star Didier Drogba is making a big impact for the Montreal Impact in his inaugural Major League Soccer season. the VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Segun Dot, on the spot. Adeyemi reports.
Didier Drogba scored twice in the first 12 minutes to propel his club, Montreal Impact, to a 2-0 win over DC United. The victory stretches Montreal Impact's unbeaten streak to 6 games. The former Chelsea striker now has 7 goals in 6 MLS games since making his debut last month. Elsewhere, Brazil and Barcelona star Neymar is in trouble. A Brazilian court has frozen the assets of Neymar, his family, and related businesses, valued at $48 million. The Sao Paulo Federal Court said that the 23-year-old evaded almost $16 million in Brazil taxes between 2011 and 2013. He moved from Brazilian club Santos to Spain's Barcelona in 2013. Experts said Neymar is not likely to go to jail if he pays what he owes. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thank you, Segun. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. And my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. One of my recent tweets was retweeted by Ghanaian footballer Joshua Yaro, a student athlete at Georgetown University here in Washington. Joshua has been a guest on the Sunny Side of Sports, and he liked a quote I tweeted by the late Hall of Fame basketball coach John Wooden. Success is peace of mind, which is a direct result of knowing you did your best to become the best that you are capable of being. Words of wisdom from the Wizard of Westwood, John Wooden. On the Facebook front, check out my page and you'll see a wonderful photo of Didier Drogba smiling at the camera after scoring one of his goals over the weekend for the Montreal Impact in Major League Soccer. The photo generated a few comments from my Facebook friends. Bishops Edwin, writing from Trinidad, Cuba, says, "This guy Drogba does not want to stop scoring. That's good for football and Africa." Spencer Okuk, who studied at Lagos State University in Nigeria's commercial capital, writes, "Sonny, Drogba is a true legend, and he's still very hot. He can't stop scoring goals." And Bernard Ayisi, writing from Konongo, Ghana, refers back to Drogba's stellar performances for the Blues of Chelsea. Bernard writes, "Drogba likes best anything blue." And yes, the photo shows Drogba in a blue Montreal Impact kit. Blue socks, blue shirts, and blue jersey. Go Didier Drogba. Keep scoring those goals. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a UN special investigator warns Burundi could slip back into open warfare. And next, pros and cons of genetically modified crops. But first, some music. Here is Tikin Jaffa Kole from Ivory Coast with African Revolution.
Doing it will open your eyes. education. Go to school, my brother. I said, go to school. You will understand very soon all the problems of your nation. We want a revolution. Young people revolution. Intelligent revolution. Must be African education. In your mind, brother, there is the power to change the world. This understanding will help to make a better place. In your hands, brother, there is the key to this continent. And if you don't unlock it soon, it will be lost to the government.
Tike Njapakoli from Ivory Coast with African Revolution.
Well, the UN today reports a large number of mass arrests, killings, and torture in Burundi. The Human Rights Report follows testimony last week in Geneva by a UN special investigator who urged the international community to take urgent preventive action. Lisa Schlein reports from the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva, where the investigator submitted his report.
Pablo de Greiff, a UN special investigator on mass violations, says much has happened since he visited Burundi in December, and none of it good. He says Burundi has turned away from the peaceful path it had followed since the 2000 Arusha agreement that ended the country's civil war. He says the government of President Pierre Nkurunziza is no longer attempting to build a society based on the rule of law, and that the tradition of impunity from past decades has become further entrenched and is being used as a tool of repression and violence. De Greiff says he presented his concerns to the UN Human Rights Council in hopes that member states understand the gravity of the situation unfolding in Burundi and take measures to head off a disaster.
Here, I want to be very honest, trying to sound a very urgent cautionary call to the international community not to wait until we have another tragedy in our hands before we take action.
Some 3,000 people were killed in Burundi during the civil war. The country was relatively peaceful in recent years until the end of April, when the president announced he would seek a controversial third term. Since then, de Greiff says, there have been more than 100 killings, hundreds of arbitrary arrests, and many cases of torture and ill treatment. He says none of these cases is being investigated except for one that involves a government official. The president was re-elected in July, but tension remains between his supporters and those who say he violated the two-term limit in the Constitution. The UN investigator says the international community and regional governments cannot afford to simply stand by and wait for new mass atrocities to recur in Burundi. He warns this would risk a major conflict in the Great Lakes region with unpredictable and frightening results. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Genetically modified crops first appeared in global markets in the mid-90s, but most African nations have remained lukewarm about embracing them. Today, rising hunger rates, unpredictable weather patterns, disease and pest attacks are contributing to concerns about food security. There's also leading Africa governments to think again about adopting scientifically enhanced foods. From Douala, Cameroon, Ntiriake Divine Jr. reports.
Mere mention of genetically modified organisms or GMOs has triggered vibrant debate across Africa.
We are talking about those organisms modified artificially using technology in the laboratory.
Professor Vincent Titanji is Vice Chancellor at the Cameroon Christian University in Yaoundé.
You bring genes from one species to another and then either improve or change it in some manner that it becomes more efficient in its environment. For instance, in agriculture, certain crops can be modified so that they will be resistant to some pests, some destructive events like climate change and so on.
But despite such advances, concerns about GMOs have generally dwarfed the benefits across Africa. From policymakers to farmers and consumers, most agriculture stakeholders reject GMOs as an answer to rising malnutrition and outdated farming methods. In Cameroon's rural areas, for example, highly religious peasant farmers consider genetic modification outright blasphemy. Beatrice Ngenge, a maize grower in the country's hilly northwest, compares GMOs to attempts at human cloning by scientists in the West. She says they are both responsible for human suffering.
Whenever we go against God, we must prepare to bear the consequences. How can simple human beings think they are God?
Many like her stick tightly to antiquated farming methods, only reluctantly embracing pesticides and fertilizers to improve yields. Such hardline attitudes are reinforced by civil society activists. Bernard Njonga is leader of the Cameroon Collective Against GMOs. He says, like narcotics, genetically altered planting material will eventually hook farmers, rendering them dependent on seeds and chemicals they cannot afford.
Imagine the petit paysan. S'il utilise l'OGM, il est obligé de racheter.
Imagine the peasant farmer using GMOs that he obliged to purchase. He will need authorization because GMOs are patented. They threaten the health of the population because some are said to cause cancer. France, Germany, England have prohibited GMOs from their farms and plates. Why should we foolishly embrace them? From now on, we would fight to prevent this evil from entering Cameroon.
Et on se battra pour que ce mal n'entre pas au Cameroun.
Njonga voiced the opposition in early September at a first ever government-organized forum on the stakes and challenges of adopting GMOs to boost Cameroon's agricultural production. Besides oil, agriculture has been the backbone of the Central African nation's economy, employing over 70% of its workforce and contributing enormously to its GDP. But in recent years, and with food prices exploding amid harvest slumps, the government is considering dropping its precautionary stance on genetically modified organisms. Emmanuel Bonde is Minister of Mines, Industries and Technological Development. He says the plan to embrace GMOs will be gradual.
Cette question fait l'objet de débats contradictoires.
This issue evokes debates. Therefore, we would first reinforce the capacity of our conventional agriculture through increased mechanization and local transformation before contemplating the controlled integration of GMOs in our development process.
Dans notre processus de développement.
He says the scare campaign by anti-GMO activists is scientifically groundless. So far, there have been no reported allergies, human health complications, or long-term negative side effects from consuming genetically modified organisms. And besides, advocates add that Africa is teetering on the brink of starvation, with some 2.9 million hunger-related deaths per year. They say failure to consider scientifically improved yields means continued dependence on Western food aid.
Les OGM sont certainement un facteur de développement.
GMOs are certainly a factor of development because if we consider our food security and population growth in Cameroon within the context of stagnating agricultural production.
Stagne ou baisse.
Waman Mbele is a senior official in the Ministry of the Environment. He says Cameroon and Africa in general will eventually have no choice but resort to GMOs.
It is only normal to revert to advanced technologies. Today, cotton production is stagnating and growers are envisaging genetically modified cotton as a solution.
He argues GMO crops that can be grown in less time and with reduced production costs will lift millions out of poverty and curb rising hunger. However, he warns that African governments planning to embrace the biotechnology should introduce precise legislation and support public enlightenment campaigns to help reduce consumer opposition to GMO foods. From Douala in Cameroon, I'm Tariq Edovan Jr. for VOA News.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehius Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
South Sudan, the world's newest country and one of its least developed, faces many humanitarian challenges. Today, it suffers in the world's worst food security crisis, one caused primarily by man-made violence. More than two decades of North-South conflict, followed by factional fighting that erupted almost 2 years ago, have further weakened an already fragile nation and undermined its ability to protect and feed its people. The South Sudanese conflict has been particularly difficult on the civilian population. Thousands of people have been killed and more than 2.2 million driven from their homes. More than 600,000 have fled to neighboring states. Nearly 4.6 million, or 40% of the population, face acute hunger, particularly those living in the most conflict-affected areas of Unity, Upper Nile, and Jonglei states. Still, there is hope. In late August, the heads of the two warring parties signed a peace agreement that could bring an end to the fighting and set the country on a road to recovery. In view of this positive development, the United States has announced an additional $80 million in humanitarian assistance for the people of South Sudan, specifically aimed at helping South Sudanese refugees. This brings the total U.S. assistance since the start of the conflict to over $1.3 billion. The funding will aid those most in need, including internally displaced persons, refugees seeking asylum in South Sudan, and those South Sudanese who are living as refugees in neighboring nations. The United States urges all signatories of the peace agreement to uphold their obligations to the people of South Sudan and to allow immediate, full, and unconditional humanitarian access to all populations in need in all areas of South Sudan. They must also ensure the safety and security of civilians, humanitarian workers, and humanitarian supplies. There is a long road ahead, and this is the first step.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.
next on Let's Talk. Punctuality. Does it matter to you? Does it affect your views about someone when you meet to do business? Join host Sande Shomari and his guests discussing punctuality. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.